All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Push Podcast.
Welcome.
I'm Megan, OBGYN and clinical researcher.
And I'm Sydney. I'm a labor and delivery nurse, educator, and content creator.
Perfect. And today we are talking about a topic that I definitely talk a lot about with my patients.
Yes.
The birth control pill.
The pill. A lot of talk online as well about the birth control pill, positive and negatives, but definitely probably higher on the negative side of things, honestly.
No, the birth control pill has really become villainized in the last few years,
oh,
I think.
Yeah, hey? Yeah, for sure. For sure. I think a lot of people are kind of taking a step back from hormonal birth control. Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of people are kind of wanting to do more like their natural cycles and tracking and all that kind of stuff. But that's kind of why we want to talk about it today. Especially, I want to pick your brain all about it because you prescribe birth control all the time to your patients, right?
I do. I prescribe a lot of the like combined hormonal contraceptives.
Okay.
Oh, pause. Technical difficulty. My iPad just died.
Okay, technical difficulties. We're back.
Sorry, guys.
iPad's not working. That's fine.
I feel like you will come to expect this a lot from me in the course of this. I am embarrassingly bad with my technology.
Oh,
sometimes.
So am I. So truly.
I'm having charger cord issues with my iPad today, but that's okay. Now I've got my big laptop here and we're going to continue. So as I was saying, I actually prescribe a lot of the pill or the like combined oral contraceptive, mostly for non-contraceptive reasons in my practice.
Yeah.
But I do want to establish right from the jump, mm-hmm. as we're talking about this, that I, first of all, as basically a characteristic of my practice, I prescribe a ton of different birth control pills. Mm. And we'll talk about why I do that and kind of what are the reasons in which someone might benefit from one pill and not another as we go through the episode. But on that note, too, I prescribe a ton of them from different manufacturers, and I have no financial disclosures in this. So this is a common thing that we say in presentations in academia. We start our presentations by saying and by listing whether you're on speaker committees or contribute to research done by industry on different medications and instruments. I have no financial disclosures in general, but certainly with respect to the pill, I have none. And so I won't be mentioning any brand names today. Mm-hmm. Industry, I'm open to financial disclosures. Just kidding.
I love it.
But important, I think, as we're talking about like a medication that I address that right off the jump.
Are there, can I just while you say that, is there a lot of like care providers who have to disclose like that's
absolutely
a frequent thing because I feel like the general public doesn't really know that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what? I do think that we've moved a long way from the era where, you know, doctors were invited to come on like ski trips or cruises hosted by drug companies or industry in general.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So really most of our disclosures now or physicians that do work with industry is not the enemy, right? Mm-hmm. Like these companies are the ones that are in many cases doing kind of the largest, most cleanly executed clinical trials for some, you know, medications, right?
That are needed. There's
life-saving medications manufactured by private companies.
Yeah.
But most of our involvement now does tend to be a little bit more on the like expert impact side of things.
Gotcha. That makes sense.
But in any case, I have none. I just use these medications a lot.
Yeah.
I'm also a human who was on the birth control pill for a long time, especially when I was younger.
Yeah.
And I'm really lucky that I didn't tend to have a lot of side effects when I was on the birth control pill.
Yeah.
But I did have a lot of nausea with it. And so I was one of those people who couldn't take the pill too close together. Like if I forgot one dose, I could never just double up on the doses.
Because it would make you feel sick.
Yes, I would throw up. I honestly, I was really sensitive to what I now know is the estrogen component to the birth control pill. But I think part of what has motivated me to talk about this in a little bit more detail is I had no idea that it didn't need to be that way, right? I would have never have known to ask what dose of estrogen I was on in that on that particular pill or to even know that some side effects are mediated by one component versus the other and that you can actually titrate your pill or your response to the pill based on which one you're choosing. I just thought kind of they were all created equally. And so that's part of why I was really excited to tackle this topic today.
Yeah. It was one of the first topics you were like, we need to do one on the birth control pill. You're very passionate about it. And I'm like, yeah, let's do it.
Well, I just feel like there's so many misconceptions about the pill. And while it doesn't work for all people, I do find in my practice when I ask people why they didn't tolerate the pill, a lot of the time it comes down to kind of these modifiable factors, right? So like people had a side effect that we can account for with a different selection of pill, or they didn't like it for, you know, a particular reason that is maybe no longer true. And so I do find that there's like a lot of unpacking that I do in my practice. And so I'm happy to get the opportunity to do that
to share it on a larger scale and hopefully help people, you know, be able to make more informed decisions for themselves about the pill. And if there's, you know, different components that they're not, they didn't know existed about different pills and like things to advocate for themselves for trying a different pill versus what they're on.
Totally.
Or the reason why they're on birth control too, right? Because there's a lot of a lot of people don't actually use it for like contraception purposes. Like there's other reasons you can actually be on the pill. So we can 100%. Talk about that too.
Sydney, do you have any biases to disclose with the pill?
No, I don't. I don't think so. I also myself like have been on birth control in my life. I was on the hormonal birth control pill, you know, when I was a teenager. I think I first got on it for acne, which is usually what most teenagers get put on it for, is some acne. And then I never actually had side effects at all. Like I actually really liked the birth control pill. I can't even remember which one I was on, but I took that for many years.
None of us know.
No,
right?
I don't even know. I know at one point a lot of my friends were on like Yasmin. Like that was like a huge one, but I can't even remember which one I was on. But anyways, and then I was having really heavy periods that were also causing me to feel really lightheaded and really sick. Like I would miss school because of it. And well, at least try to. My mom never let me. She's like, it's your period. Go to school. You're fine.
Sam, no, that's not how we talk about periods. She's going to be so mad.
Yeah, she is. She is. But you know what? Anyways, she would still support me. But yeah, she's like, go to school. And then I realized when I took the birth control pill, I could skip my periods. Yeah. Right. So I would skip the sugar pills, and my family doctor was like, it's completely fine to do that. You can just skip your period altogether. And that has a lot of misconceptions too, because I would tell people like my mom, my friends, that I skip it altogether. I don't get a period. And they were like, are you sure that's okay? Like, is that safe for your body to do that? And I'm like, I don't know. My doctor told me it is, but I don't actually know. You know, there's a lot of like you feel as a woman like you need to have a menstrual cycle, right? Yes. And that's just part of the natural cycle of like clearing your uterus. And I just never enjoyed having a period. Like I never had severe, you know, some people who have like endometriosis and stuff, they have really heavy periods with all these side effects. I think it just made me feel not great when I had my period, which I mean, for most of us, it doesn't make you feel great. Yeah. So I didn't want to have a period anymore.
That's so fair. And I'm so happy that you brought that up, because I cannot wait to talk about skipping periods on the pill and unpacking again some of the myths and misconceptions around why the pill break exists and what purpose it serves within the menstrual cycle.
Yeah, I'm really interested in hearing this answer.
But speaking of menstrual cycles, before we get into kind of the fun history of the pill, or I mean, listen, I'm a big nerd about stuff like this, so I think this history is fun.
It's good to know where it came from, for sure.
Let's first talk a little bit about the menstrual cycle. And I'm going to try and keep this as simplified as possible. So if there are any, you know, reproductive biologists out there listening, don't come at me for the simplification.
Yeah.
We're trying to make this like as accessible and easy to understand as possible.
For sure.
So basically, in order for menstruation to occur, your brain and your ovaries need to be talking to each other. Mm-hmm. So menstruation really like is a function of uterine shedding. So we're shedding the endometrial lining of your uterus. And that's the part that grows and sheds in response to hormones every single time we have a menstrual cycle. And it's that shedding of the lining that causes the bleeding that we see during our period.
Yes.
However, most of the discussion is really happening not at the level of the uterus, but between your brain and your ovaries. So your brain releases a hormone at the start of your menstrual cycle called FSH, or follicle stimulating hormone. Mm-hmm. And basically, this hormone tells your ovaries to start getting eggs ready for ovulation. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sure everybody's familiar with the concept that we're born with all the eggs that we're ever going to have in our life.
Oh, yes.
Right?
That's what everyone says for sure.
Exactly. So these eggs basically live in things called follicles inside the ovaries, which are these little sacs that contain like a primitive form of the egg.
But it is true. We are born with all of our eggs, right?
Yeah. We're not producing more eggs during our reproductive lifespan.
I just want to make that extra clear.
Yes. But they're not like sitting there ready to like hatch, right? They exist kind of in a premature form through most of our reproductive lifespan. Mm-hmm. So when your ovaries see this follicle stimulating hormone, groups of these follicles basically start getting ready. They start maturing those premature eggs so that one might be released. Exactly. And these follicles start producing estrogen, which is one of the hormones that we know of, I think, commonly with respect to like our reproductive lifespan, right?
Yeah.
That estrogen then helps to get your endometrial lining nice and thick. Mm-hmm. So again, that's the inner lining of the uterus. And the purpose of it getting nice and thick is basically to have a soft place to land for a fertilized egg to implant and to start to develop into eventually a baby.
A baby.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Eventually, one of those follicles basically starts to outstrip the other. So it wins. Mm. And that one starts producing a ton more estrogen. This is called the dominant follicle. Mm. And the reason for this function is basically so that we don't release 20 eggs every cycle and have these like huge gravid pregnancies, right?
Right. So have quadruplets, quintuplets.
Exactly, all the time. So for most of us, we release one egg per month, and it's this dominant follicle that basically pushes back all the others and starts producing a lot of estrogen so that one egg is released every cycle.
That makes sense.
This sudden increase in the estrogen as this dominant follicle starts to win the race tells your brain that this is happening, right? That there's a follicle that's basically ready to be ovulated. And it sends out luteinizing hormone, or LH. And this is where we hear about like the LH surge that happens right before ovulation.
Yes.
So that luteinizing hormone goes down to your ovaries and says, it's time to ovulate, okay? Mm-hmm. And then ovulation occurs where that dominant follicle releases its egg.
Yeah.
Okay?
And that's usually when you have like a spike in your temperature too, right?
Exactly.
Like your body temperature. Yeah.
Exactly.
So that's how people do the natural cycle. Natural cycle.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So this is kind of all part and parcel of that process. Mm-hmm. Okay, so ovulation has occurred. The egg is starting to travel down the fallopian tube. What happens to the rest of the dominant follicle? Mm-hmm. It's still kind of actually important. So that remnant becomes something called the corpus luteum. Mm-hmm. And the corpus luteum produces a hormone called progesterone. Progesterone is important to sustain the endometrial lining, basically to like hold it and make it stable so that a pregnancy can start to develop, okay?
Gotcha.
So the corpus luteum starts producing progesterone in large amounts. It can only work by itself for so long, though. Mm. And so basically, if no implantation occurs, so if an egg is not fertilized and does not implant into the endometrium, the corpus luteum stops producing progesterone and we get a sharp drop in that hormone, okay? That drop in progesterone is what signals to your uterus to shed the lining and give you a period.
And have a period.
Exactly, right. Exactly. Now, after our lining is shed, we have low levels of estrogen, low levels of progesterone, right? Because we no longer have that dominant follicle or the follicles throwing out estrogen. The corpus luteum has stopped producing progesterone, so low levels of both of those reproductive hormones. And those low levels are seen by your brain. Mm. And your brain starts then producing follicle stimulating hormone all over again.
And it's just a big cycle.
Exactly. So we have this dance of hormones that's occurring every single month, and that's what regulates our menstrual cycle.
Gotcha. Now, hormones are crazy.
Hormones are so crazy.
They do, and again, so many things.
Oh my gosh. I actually loved learning about all of, and this is like one small corner of our hormonal axes in our bodies.
Yes.
And it's so much more complicated and in-depth than this in practice, because there's all these different ways that like estrogen is not just produced sometimes by the follicles, and there's ways that, you know, hormones travel and are stored throughout the body that can impact the way that our bodies feel them. But this is kind of the simplified version of the menstrual cycle. And it's so, so interesting because it is. It's this like very delicate dance that occurs.
Yes.
And kind of needs to happen in this particular way in order for our menstrual cycles to function as they're designed to.
Yeah.
Okay.
It also makes me appreciate like conception in general and how much needs to happen and be like perfect in order for a baby to like start to form. I don't know. Crazy.
Oh my gosh. I remember when I was in medical school learning about human development and just thinking like, what a miracle it is that anybody is born ever, because the amount of things that needs to happen in order for a human to develop is just wild. It's like, it's so crazy and humbling.
Yeah.
Okay. So how does the pill impact these cycles? So basically, within the combined oral contraceptive, or COC, this is the pill that we kind of know of as the pill, right? And it contains a synthetic version of both estrogen and progesterone.
Yeah.
Okay. Basically, what this gives, in essence, is the steady medium state of hormones. So you don't get the wild fluctuations. You don't get the ups and downs. And so your brain doesn't see that and send out things like follicle stimulating hormone to produce an egg. With this steady estrogen, so again, the brain never really sends out FSH or LH in those large amounts. So that steady state, in essence, prevents ovulation, right? Okay. And if no egg is released, then no baby can grow,
and,
right?
And it prevents the uterine lining from thickening too?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So we never really get the thickness of the endometrial lining.
Okay.
Now, the progesterone in the pill helps by blunting your LH surge. So you never really get that surge of the luteinizing hormone, but it also does things like thickening the cervical mucus and thinning the endometrial lining and slowing the passage of an egg down the fallopian tube. And again, these kind of all, it's like multi-layered protection against pregnancy. But basically, I think also important to know about this is that the period that we have on the pill is not caused by your period itself, right? Because we are not going through this cycle of hormones if you're giving yourself a steady state, right, of estrogen and progesterone.
Yeah.
Many manufactured pills today have either 24 pills with hormones in them or 21 pills with hormones in them, followed by this hormone-free interval or sugar pill.
Yeah, the sugar pills.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, either the white ones.
Exactly, exactly. They're color-coded. They're different. They're at the end of your pack.
Yes.
Usually there's either 7 or 4 of them, depending on the formulation.
Yeah.
And basically what this does is give you a withdrawal of the hormones, right? So it mimics that progesterone drop, and it causes your endometrial lining to shed. But it's not a period in the sense that you're not having like a normal menstrual cycle, right?
Yes.
We're just withdrawing those hormones and signaling to your brain to shed the, or rather to your uterus to shed the lining. Endometrial lining.
Gotcha.
Exactly. Exactly. But Sydney, do you know why the hormone-free interval exists?
I feel like I've heard on social media, which I have no idea if it's true, but it's something in the past. I don't know. I'm going to butcher this, but like, I think it was like in history, I don't know if it was men or something, someone created the birth control pill and then they needed to prove that women were still having cycles or something. I don't know. I saw something online that was something along these lines where they like needed to have those like 7 days of having a period or something to do with that. I don't know. See, this is the information I get online.
No, but this is what's good. And honestly, that's not far from the truth.
Okay.
Right? All of this does kind of circle around the concept of what a natural cycle should look like and why that might be important to people.
Yeah, yeah.
So to paint the picture, in the early 20th century, and we'll talk mostly about the United States because that's where the birth control pill was developed, but I think we can assume some similar circumstances around the world. Basically, reproductive rights really were more about control than choice at that time. Back in the late 1800s, the United States government passed something called the Comstock Law, which basically made it illegal to distribute contraceptives of any kind. So that included non-hormonal management as well, right? Obviously, the pill didn't exist at that time. And it also made it illegal to even distribute information about preventing pregnancy.
Yeah.
By males specifically, but that was, you know, extrapolated to in person.
For sure.
And these federal laws were followed by a bunch of state level bans as well. And that basically made it nearly impossible for people to access not only contraceptives, but information about contraceptives. So if you were a woman in this time frame, basically talking about contraception could get you arrested.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what happened to Margaret Sanger, who was a very famous nurse and activist in the United States at this time. She opened the very first birth control clinic in Brooklyn in 1916 based on experiences that she had with her patients, particularly those that were impoverished at the time. She was jailed for opening up this clinic almost immediately, but her arrest helped to spark a more of a national conversation about this. So by the 1930s and 40s, people were talking about this more and more, and doctors were getting more involved in the conversation as well. They could sometimes prescribe contraceptives for health reasons, but again, like, just preventing pregnancy wasn't necessarily, it wasn't necessarily seen to be enough. And more than the legality too, I think it's important to acknowledge at this point that then, like now, the restrictions on contraceptives affected racialized and economically challenged families more than people who were white and more than people who had money, right? Poor women and women of color were disproportionately affected by these laws and by the unavailability of contraception. And oftentimes when they sought out contraception, they were actually offered sterilization as opposed to just means of preventing pregnancy at that time.
Which at the time too, like, giving women that choice of when they can, when they want to have a family, if they do want to have a family, was so powerful, right? Because it was giving women the chance to have careers too, right?
100%. 100%.
So, that's so sad that that happened, but...
So by the 1950s, we're in this, like, weird tension, right, where the post-war baby boom is happening. But at the same time, you know, increasingly women and families are asking themselves, how can I shape my family in a way that makes the most sense for us, right? So enter about four key players at this time. So Margaret Sanger, who we've already mentioned, who ultimately founded the organization that became Planned Parenthood in the United States. Gregory Pincus, who is a reproductive biologist, already working on the pharmacologic background of preventing ovulation. John Rock, who was an OBGYN and a fertility specialist at that time, actually, as well. And Catherine McCormick, who was a biology grad herself, but a philanthropist at the time.
Oh, interesting.
So these people in 1951 have a real meeting of the minds, and they begin developing a hormonal contraceptive. Importantly, that same year, the Catholic Church announced that they remained resolutely opposed to artificial birth control methods. However, Pope Pius during that time announced that the Catholic Church would sanction the rhythm method as a natural method of birth control. So previously, the only thing that was accepted by Rome was abstinence. So now we're starting to say, okay, if we're just going with the natural cycle, we can potentially get on board with planning pregnancy or planning for pregnancies. Now, it's hard to say exactly what the 7-day pill break, what was in the minds of the people
where
who
it came from exactly.
Who were developing the birth control pill. However, John Rock did publish many papers trying to get the Catholic Church on board because he himself was a Catholic. And felt that it was well within the doctrine to accept this form of planning. And so there's a theory that part of why the birth control pill or the hormone-free interval exists is to appease the Catholic Church to say, listen, this is actually really similar to natural methods, right? Women are still having cycles. And so this is as natural as rhythm method.
It's not messing with anything. Why not accept it?
I think practically, though, what was useful about the pill break at that time was that it did approximate a natural cycle. And so at a time when contraceptive was really, or contraceptives were really controversial, it allowed women to potentially have that information be something that was private and kept from their communities, their families, and sometimes even their partners, right? And to make that choice for themselves. Importantly, though, it wasn't until, so even after the birth control pill became commercially acceptable and available in the United States, it initially wasn't available for contraceptive, as with many things. It was available for menstrual disorders and to help treat them. It wasn't until 1965 that the Supreme Court legalized the birth control pill for married couples. And it wasn't until 1972 that it became legal to access the birth control pill if you were unmarried. And so this is still really within living history, right? That you couldn't necessarily access this like easy daily form of birth control in order to make sure that you could form your family when and if you wanted to.
Exactly, which is so important, I feel like, nowadays especially. But
well, here's the thing. The pill really was responsible for reshaping global economies because overwhelmingly this allowed women to enter systems of education, to achieve higher level degrees, to enter into the workforce, and to stay in the workforce long term.
Yes, yes.
And so this had a huge economic impact in the U.S. and throughout the world.
Yeah.
And again, really reshaped kind of the education system and the global economy as we know it, as women were able to participate in areas of work that they were not previously able to because they could not prevent pregnancy in a meaningful or reliable way.
Yeah, and they never had that choice.
Exactly, exactly. So this is part of why I feel so, you know, I feel it's so important to understand the origins of the birth control pill too, because while there's lots of really valid critiques, I think, about how we use it and why and when, I think it's also important to hold space for the original meaning of the birth control pill for women across the United States, across Canada, and across the world, right? In that it allowed us to achieve lots of dreams that were previously not practically accessible.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Exactly. It was a really radical feminist intervention at the time, even though now it's very commonplace.
Yeah. But it is like still somewhat recent though. Like hearing about it only being available to every woman unmarried or married in 1972, that's like in the grand scheme of things, that's not that long.
No, it's really not that long ago, which is wild.
Yeah.
Now, before we get into the birth control pill today and what we use it for and how to kind of talk about like who it might be good for, I thought it would be good to do some rapid fire fact or fiction.
Fact or fiction, yes. Yeah. Because there's a lot of myths out there for sure.
Totally, totally. So Sydney, do you want to ask me some burning questions from the social media sphere?
Yes. Okay. Birth control pill makes you infertile or decreases your fertility?
Myth. Super myth. And we know this because people do get pregnant on the pill, right?
Mm-hmm.
But really, even when we look at larger studies and the data, there's no evidence that there's a delay of return to fertility.
Okay. So you don't need to be like off of the pill for years before you want to try and have a baby kind of thing.
Absolutely not. Okay. Most people resume normal ovulation within 1 to 3 months after stopping the pill.
Oh, so really frequent, really like soon after.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And sometimes even sooner.
Mm, interesting.
Yeah.
Another thing I wanted to ask was, I guess I kind of already asked it earlier, but do you need the breaks then? It's seeming like you do not need the breaks, but is it required?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
You do not need a pill break. If you're cycling naturally, right, you should have a period every month.
Mm.
And the reason for that is we don't want the endometrial lining to continue to build up with this as a response to estrogen, because that can put you at risk of uterine cancer in the long run if this lining is kind of just allowed to build up unchecked and never get the signal to shed.
Mm.
However, there's no medical need for withdrawal bleeds. So again, keep in mind, back to our original physiology, you're not building up your lining when you're on the birth control pill. And so there's actually no medical purpose to the hormone-free interval. And we actually frequently, for lots of different medical reasons, encourage people to use the pill in what we would call a continuous fashion. So just continue on.
Is that something more recent nowadays versus in the past? Like are OBGYNs nowadays saying, you know, or recommending for patients to stay on it more than they did in the past, do you think? Or,
you know, it's hard to say. I think maybe as we have come to kind of come back to the origins of the pill and as we've come to use it maybe more frequently and more in a more nuanced fashion for menstrual disorders as opposed to just for contraception, maybe we've come to a place where we're using it continuously in a, you know, more frequently.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
One more thing that I want to address I get asked a lot, I think increasingly, is does the pill cause breast cancer?
Oh.
So I've read a lot of a lot of discussion on social media in particular about people who feel that their breast cancer was caused by the birth control pill.
Yes.
And actually, there is some truth to that. Mm-hmm, okay.
Mm-hmm.
When we've looked, and there have been some good large scale studies that have been done that have shown that there is an increase of up to 20 to 30% while taking the birth control pill. But the absolute risk of breast cancer is still small, and it returns to baseline within about 5 to 10 years of stopping. So okay. Really, I think this gets into a little bit of the weeds of research in general. So mm-hmm. What is relative risk versus mm-hmm. absolute risk?
Mm-hmm.
So you can think about it like this. I went to ChatGPT actually to say, like, how do I explain this concept in a way that makes sense?
Yeah.
And this is what GPT suggested. She said, think of it like this. If your chance of getting rained on is 1 in 100 and I tell you something makes it 20% more likely, it is now 1.2 in 100.
Okay.
Right?
So it's still small.
Still small. Exactly. It does not, it's more likely, sure, but it's still not very likely overall. So yeah. That's the difference here. Your likelihood, especially for young women, mm-hmm. of getting breast cancer is still quite small.
Mm-hmm.
And you maybe have a 20% chance higher, so now a 1.2 as opposed to 1 chance of having breast cancer during that time. But again, mm-hmm. it goes away after the pill is stopped.
So, that's so interesting, because to me, like 20%, when you say 20 to 30%, that sounds huge.
It sounds huge. But right? In practice, for most of us, the risk is still not very high. I think the flip side of the pill and cancer, too, is that it does reduce the risk of ovarian and endometrial cancer.
Yes, which I think a lot of people don't know either.
No, exactly.
Right?
And again, the easy way to think of it is that many ovarian cancers start actually on the outside of the ovary.
Mm.
And cancers in general or areas of the body that are particularly predisposed to cancer are those that change frequently, mm-hmm. right? Because cancer is often an error that occurs as yeah. cells are replicating and or repairing themselves. And so if you have an area of the body that's changing a lot, then that can be an area that's a little bit more at risk. And so if your ovary is bursting at mm-hmm. the outside every single month, then that's an area that is potentially at risk for developing a cancer. And so if we're mm-hmm. preventing ovulation, we think that we're also preventing kind of that repair cycle that can occur where errors can happen.
Yeah, interesting. Mm-hmm. In this kind of the same vein, I'm not sure if you even know the answer to this, but mm-hmm. Does pregnancy itself increase your risk of breast cancer at all or anything in that, you know, if you're pregnant, do you have a risk because of the different hormones and everything?
No. And in fact, pregnancy, and I will fact check myself on this.
Yeah.
But pregnancy, again, is a risk reduction for many cancers.
Including in most of the cancers.
Like ovarian cancers.
That's what I yeah. thought. I've had a couple patients actually, mm-hmm. unfortunately, be diagnosed with breast cancer like mm-hmm. postpartum.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of times that's because they have like a clogged milk duct, or they think it's a clogged milk duct, but it's actually like a mass.
Yeah.
So always check your boobs, ladies.
I think the challenge with pregnancy and breast cancer, to get off track a little bit,
yeah,
but,
yeah.
is really just in the ways that we're able to screen for breast cancer, the yeah. imaging modalities and their effectiveness in somebody who is breastfeeding, right?
Yeah.
And again, this sense that like perhaps our concerns about lumps, pain in the breasts may be not investigated as thoroughly as they should be at a time mm-hmm. when someone, it's easy for somebody to say, oh, well, you're breastfeeding, right? It's normal to have
yes.
pain. It's normal it's normal to feel engorged. It's normal to have a lump, right?
Yes, yes.
And so I think that that is part of what kind of is the underlying factor of the challenges sometimes in diagnosing these.
That makes sense. Okay, sorry. Back to all about the hormonal birth control pill. But I actually, while you were talking, I thought of another question that I feel like I see a lot online and mm-hmm. actually in my personal life dealing with friends mm-hmm. who've been on the pill. A lot of them dislike the birth control pill because they feel like it caused them to gain a lot of weight.
That
How do you feel about that?
Really common thing that people say
right?
as well.
Yeah.
And I would say that's partly myth.
Okay.
So the best studies that we have that look at large numbers of people over time don't show any association with consistent weight gained with the combined oral contraceptive pill. Mm-hmm. So again, this is like the most common pill that we would see online.
Mm-hmm.
Some people may find that they have fluid retention, right? So bloating, mm-hmm. that is certainly seen with some of the pills.
Okay.
Usually time limited, usually refined to kind of the first few months that somebody is taking it. But we don't typically tend to see again, in this population-based data, an association with increased fat gain.
Okay, so kind of in the same concept, what are some side effects of the birth control pill? Like, what are things that patients experience most with it and how to prevent them? Or, you know, do you just change different pills? Like, how do you go about that with your patients?
Great question. And I think something that we don't discuss enough, when, especially when we're prescribing the pill for contraception, right, which is like probably the number one reason why people start the birth control pill, is that some side effects are mediated by the estrogen component, some side effects are mediated by the progesterone component, and some side effects are kind of shared by both. And so if we're trying to put somebody on a different pill that mitigates some of those side effects, it's helpful to know like what they were specifically so that we can make a wiser decision with the next choice.
Right.
So estrogen mediated side effects tend to be things like nausea, which I experienced, increased vaginal discharge, sometimes a small increase in blood pressure, and then breakthrough bleeding, especially associated with like lower doses of estrogen.
Right.
There also is a risk associated with estrogen of getting a blood clot in either the legs or the lungs, as well as stroke and heart attack. Again, these are, when we talk, thinking back to our relative versus absolute risk, your absolute risk of getting any of these things is very, very, very low for an otherwise healthy young person. But the estrogen component does increase the relative risk a small amount, right? So again, that like 1 to 1.1 or 1.2, for example.
Yeah. Have you ever seen that in your practice?
Like, I have never seen a blood clot associated with birth control pill use.
Yeah.
However, I imagine probably some of our family doctor colleagues and emergency medicine colleagues probably have.
I've seen it in pregnancy, like with my pregnant patients before coming in with like a DVT because of pregnancy. But yeah, I can imagine family doctors see it quite frequently. Well, hopefully not too frequently, but
Well, and that's often actually also how I counsel my patients is when we talk about relative risk.
Yeah,
the relative risk of blood clot on the birth control pill is actually lower than the relative risk of blood clot
when you're pregnant.
And so if we're talking about contraceptive use, especially the risk of having a blood clot if you get pregnant because you're using a contraceptive is actually higher.
Yeah, which it's still very low though. Still with pregnancy, I want to keep. Yes. I don't want to scare anyone, but
absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, progesterone, for its part, does have some side effects too. So the number one thing that I see with progesterone often is mood changes or irritability.
Okay.
And so this, I think, can capture kind of why people sometimes feel they have low mood associated with the birth control pill.
Yeah.
But I do think that this often is probably the case when people say things like, I just didn't feel like myself on the birth control pill. My sense is that probably we're pointing at the progesterone with respect to that side effect. Sometimes people often find that they feel a little bit more fatigued on the pill. So again, kind of same thing. They don't feel like themselves.
Yeah.
And then depending on the progesterone in the pill, some of them are a little bit more or predispose a little bit more towards acne and skin changes in general. Now, some of the shared side effects between the two that people can experience are things like decreased libido. So decreased interest in sex, melasma. So some skin darkening of the face, breast tenderness, headaches can be associated with both depending on the progestin. And then again, fluid retention and bloating.
Okay.
Same with both.
And with the headaches, I know a lot of people who like they get the migraines with the Auras, and those patients are usually advised not to take oral contraception. Is that true?
So not to take oral contraception with estrogen.
With estrogen
is the key component because of the risk of stroke associated with the estrogen component. So there are reasons why people should not take the pill. And again, this is not an exhaustive list. So please, again, always talk to your provider before starting any new medication, blah, blah, blah. You guys get it. But some of the really common reasons why somebody wouldn't be advised to take the combined oral contraceptive would be people who experience migraine with aura specifically. So visual symptoms associated with the migraines. If someone's had a history of blood clot, stroke, or heart attack, people who smoke over the age of 35, particularly if they're smoking more than 15 cigarettes a day, as well as patients with uncontrolled high blood pressure, active liver disease or tumors, and known breast cancer.
Okay.
as well as patients who have known disorders that can cause blood clots. So these would be all kind of really common reasons why we would choose a different method of contraception or a different method of treating their menstrual disorder.
Okay, so for like those patients, you could do a IUD or a progesterone-based, like only pill. That would be something
depending
that they can take.
Depending on the medical conditions themselves and their circumstances,
there's options.
Still options available to those
patients.
That's
why it's so important to like sit down and like go over it. And it has to be very individualized care because everyone is so different and everyone has a different medical background.
Exactly.
But yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, I think some of the things when we're talking about choosing the right pill, some of the important things, or one of the most important things, I think, with respect to choosing the pill, and if we're considering kind of the side effect profiles that people have had in the past, especially for those of us that might say, oh, well, I was started on the pill at 16.
Yes.
And I had nausea, right? As I did, but I don't remember what pill I was on.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We can actually tailor the choice of contraceptive or the choice of pill to the side effects that you had.
Okay.
So for someone with nausea, something like a lower dose estrogen pill would be important. Mm-hmm. We don't have many available forms of estrogen in Canada or the US, but we do have variations in the dosage that's available in the pills.
Okay.
And so lower dose pills may be better for people who have, again, more sensitivity to estrogen-mediated symptoms like breast tenderness, nausea, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Whereas a higher dose or more standard dose estrogen may be better for people who have lots of breakthrough bleeding, right?
Because
it gives a little bit better cycle control.
That makes sense.
Now, the progesterones are a totally different beast. While the estrogens are like mostly the same, just different dosages, progesterones, if you can imagine a family tree, they're actually really varied. And while some of them are more like siblings, others are more like cousins with respect to how they actually look on a biochemical level.
Okay.
And so we don't talk about that enough, I think, in that if some of the progesterones are better for some side effects versus others, and if people have had a bad side effect on a progesterone medication, I usually ask, that is where I want to know, what pill were you actually on? Mm-hmm. Because I can easily choose, if you say, for instance, well, I had a lot of acne when I took the birth control pill. My skin didn't get better. It got worse. Mm-hmm. Well, I can prescribe you a medication that actually has an anti-androgenic progesterone, or one that can help to prevent acne and help clear up your skin, as opposed to one that would maybe predispose for skin changes like that. So super important. I don't want to get too much in the weeds on all the different kinds themselves, but suffice to say that they're all really, really different. And I find it's a little bit of like lock and key with patients, in that one might work really, really well for one person and might be terrible for somebody else. And approaching it in this kind of nuanced way, asking, what were the side effects? What was the pill that you were on? Mm-hmm. When did you experience them? And what was the kind of the rollout of it is really important if we're trying to make a tailored decision for what medication somebody should be on.
So I heard online too, all this online stuff, but I heard online that some providers are actually leaning towards IUDs being their first line of treatment for contraception, even for women or girls who haven't had a baby yet. Mm-hmm. Is this true? Like, is this something that you're practicing as well? Or are you still actively like just showing everyone their options and then choosing which one works best for them? Like, what do you usually recommend to your patients?
You know, well, I would say that my personal bias is towards what I would call forgettable contraception, like an IUD.
Right.
As the proud owner of two previous IUDs myself.
Me too.
Because I am a human who cannot remember to take my pill every morning on top of all
you,
the other things
you did
I have
convince
to do
me
day.
To get an IUD, I will say.
And are you happy with your IUD?
I'm very happy, yes.
But listen, I still love the pill, right? But my practice, and I think the practice of many people, especially those that are training now, is to provide this option or this menu of options. So with most things that I would treat, I don't really feel that people need to graduate through a list of medications. I think it's much more effective, but I think also like more, you know, empowering and more, it allows us to develop a better trusting relationship if we have the opportunity to talk about what might fit well for that person.
And then let them make the decision.
And let them make the decision.
Because ultimately it is your decision. Like, exactly. It's your body.
And like I've said before, what works well for one person might not work well for another.
Yeah.
And specifically with the combined oral contraceptive pill, there's no hierarchy of like best to worst, yeah. right? It really is dependent on individual circumstances and individual goals too. And speaking of that, again, beyond contraception, coming back to the original, approvals for the pill, we actually are using these to treat menstrual disorders more and more and more.
Okay.
So contraceptive pills can be used to treat PCOS. They can be used for endometriosis, for adenomyosis, for premenstrual dysphoric disorder, for heavy menstrual bleeding. The list goes on and on. I could name forever different disorders that are well treated by the pill.
Yeah.
They also can provide menstrual suppression for people, right?
Yeah.
For people for whom their period is really, really distressing for a variety of different things.
And that's
right? Not
normal. If you're having painful periods, if you're having distressing periods, like talk to your provider, because there's things that we can do to make it easier, right? And no one should have to experience that kind of pain every single month. Like that is just not normal.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. So listen, to kind of round us all out here, I will be the last person to say that everybody needs to be on a birth control pill or anything like that. And I totally respect that hormones are kind of a hot topic right now.
Yeah.
But if there's any takeaway messages that I can leave everybody with, I think, you know, number one, right, it's that this is super individualized, right? And not only are the pills really, really variable with respect to their chemical composition, but the way that any individual responds to them is really, really different too.
Yes.
And so just because you didn't like one pill does not mean that you won't like another one.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean you have to take it. I'm not going to prescribe anything for somebody that doesn't want it.
Yeah.
Right. And
there
are other methods of contraception as we have alluded to.
Yeah.
But I don't want people to think that they're like out of the running for a pill or that it's a useless medication if they've had one bad experience.
Yes.
Right?
And I feel like this goes for almost all medications out there. It's just, you know, sometimes it takes a while to find the right fit for you. And, you know, the important part is that you're in charge. It's your choice. And I think that kind of, you know, brings us back to how important it was that the pill was created in the first place, because it really gave women a chance to choose and really gave them a lot of empowerment, right?
Oh, 100%. So, like what a privileged conversation we have even had here today, right? Where we get to talk about the pill in this kind of level of detail that we understand it and that we have this medication that has, again, allowed us to participate in the workplace. Its invention is part of why you and I are sitting here today with the level of education and experience we have.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think as Canadians, we take our reproductive rights a little bit for granted here.
We
right?
do. Yeah.
But for many women in the world, that's not the case, right? They might not have that freedom of choice.
Yeah.
And so I think, again, kind of unpacking some of these misconceptions and seeing the pill for what it is, right? A nuanced thing, something that's not one size fits all, right? But whose presence in, you know, our options, I think really represented a huge shift for cisgendered women and our ability to, you know, engage in fields that were not previously accessible to us. So,
amen. I love it. I love it. Thank you so much for sharing all of your information with us and all the studies.
Oh my gosh.
It is, I love hearing about it.
Well, I'm sure we went over time for what we'd originally planned, because as you can tell, I could talk about this forever. But please, allow me, listeners, to talk about this even more.
Absolutely.
Submit your Q&As to us. Tell us about your experiences on the pill. If there are questions that we didn't get a chance to talk about today.
Yeah. DM us on Instagram @the.push.podcast. That's where you can find us. And on TikTok.
And on TikTok.
And Facebook.
Write us
and
a
YouTube.
Comment. Exactly. Yeah. We would love to be able to unpack this even further with you guys.
Yeah. And make sure you tune back next week for a new episode of the Push Podcast. We can be found on Spotify and Apple Music.
Like, subscribe, and join us next week.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, everybody.